the seat of the intelligence, the head, you see, in the mind, where the whole seat of ahamkara, I-ness, individuality exists, you see, in this interior part of one's nature, it has to be pierced. Thorns by crowns of thorns. Actually portraying the true royalty of spirit and of the spiritualized life of perfected man. This inner kingship is never seen, recognized by the multitude. Unrecognizable to unillumined man. And so the crown is thought to be a crown of thorns. But in reality it is the crucifixion, so-called, is a coronation of the spirit. The nails through the hand. Action. Inaction. Eyelessness. Non-individuality. In feet, progress. Non-individual. Finally, in the heart. Spear wound pierces the skin deep into the inner nature so that the very last vestige of I am-ness is transcended. Symbolically, a spear wound. And interestingly, this requires a tremendous self-discipline. So who makes the spear wound? A soldier, symbol of discipline. If it's an accident, then it's a marvelous one. It's also exact, you see. Then there comes that mystery. I wish I had the language to properly describe it. Of the ever open heart, the sacred heart. It's a marvelous symbol. The heart of the initiate of the fourth and later degrees must be ever unprotected. Always open, even to the world's hate, as well as the world's aspiration, to the world's hate, which by his powers he transmutes and through his wounded hands and heart pours out as power and blessing. We must be wounded, there must be wounded. And so the wounded head, and so on. With the outstretched hands, this makes an upward-pointing triangle, thus completing the combined symbol of upward and downward-pointing triangles, two trinities in the universe and in man, being shown as now united. So the spear wound may be perhaps be regarded as representing the last surrender of self-personality, the final piercing of the skin, symbol of ahamkara, which has been led up to from the flagellation on. And the spear wound, if this is correct, indicates that the decision that the heart would thenceforth ever be open to the outflow of inward life and wisdom and the inflow and, yes, and acceptance of the world's evil as well as its aspiration to life. And no one ever aspires to light in vain. It's a law. And that's the partly of the meaning of the sacred heart, the ever-open heart. And evil is transmuted by the true alchemy of spirit and sent out to the world as blessing and power. And this is one of the characteristics of the Arhat and initiate of the fourth degree. Then there's this peculiar attribute, defenselessness, displayed as a power at the nativity. The greatest being was born into the world as a helpless babe, naked. And now it reaches its apotheosis, naked on the cross. And then there's the scepter. Do you remember the scepter? It's a reed, a mockery of the real scepter. Everything was done, you see, to mock Jesus in the narrative, unless you understand it. But what could it mean, that scepter? So weak to ordinary human view. Could it not portray the irresistible power of the divine will in nature and in man? But unillumined man, unable to perceive the spiritual power, denies its presence, disobeys its rule, and ridicules those who rely on it. They always do. For unillumined man, all that the reed scepter stands for, it is a broken reed. Meaning useless. But really, the reed in its nature, it is said to portray the irresistible power of gentleness. The greatest power of all, gentleness. Then there's the thirst, do you remember? Time. That awful time on the cross. When the initiate knows a deeper darkness than that of Gethsemane. When a gulf seems to open up between life infinite and life embodied. And he experiences for a certain time what seems to be the quintessence of loneliness. And he drinks the bitter draught of solitude, defamation, isolation, and betrayal. The father, who has yet realized and prayed to in Gethsemane, is veiled in the passion of the cross. He knows an almost cosmic loneliness, as if he alone existed. All support from without and from within, seeming for a time to be withdrawn. Even non-existent, as if there weren't anything else, and no one else but him. Naught bridges the gulf upon which hangs his helpless soul. It's part of the experience of the Arhat degree, cosmic loneliness. And then it is, in one interpretation, from the heart which feels itself deserted, there rings out the cry, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And the question may be asked, why Why this last ordeal? It is said to be necessary because the goal of human evolution, symbolized by ascension in the story of the Christ, full realization, the goal is the full realization of the individual's unity and identity with the whole. He has to learn, I suppose, through this experience, that he is the eternal, and the eternal is himself. And in the very passion of the cross, in the agony and the quintessence of loneliness, the mighty truth dawns at last fully upon him. But he is God and God is himself. He is the eternal. The eternal is himself. And he is forever in full consciousness. At one with, identical with God, and through him, and with all that lives. And then at last, when that's attained, it's over. So he says, it is finished. Last words on the cross, it is finished. And gives up the ghost. This great, wonderful coronation of the spirit, it really is over. To the world, the ignorant, the unillumined, it's a mockery. But in reality, it's a magnificent and transcendent triumph. And so, if we look at it in this way, as I'm led to do by our questioner, then the story of our Lord, from birth, even the prophecies, as we'll see later, and from his birth, is the story of man becoming perfect. Every man. One day each of us will live out that story in ourselves. And the Christ power, first born in us as only a little child, will grow. Will grow through our many lives, and ultimately we will conquer death, and this Christ presence will shine out, St. Paul puts it, in the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. So I answer our questioner, yes. He wrote it like this. Do you believe that the Master Jesus died on the cross, or that this was a myth confused with earlier Egyptian initiation rites? Not confused. I think not confused. It's too exact. The assumption here is that the authors of the four Gospels were in fact illumined Kabbalists, and were concerned less with history and more with eternal truth. To be revealed with the life story of Jesus as a central theme on which to add those transcendental and eternal truths which are beyond the limitations of history and time. Yes, we are reminded by the erudite questioner. In the Egyptian mysteries, the neophyte was buried, was bound on a cross. It was. In the old Egyptian initiatory ceremonies, the candidate for initiation was bound upon a cross, placed within a temple under the care of a priest. And in the old days, and then he was plunged into unconsciousness by the Hierophant. And the ego man, lifted from the body. and entered into buddhic consciousness for 3 days and three nights, wherein he knew, not by texts, but by vivid, direct experience, his unity with all life. I and my Father are one. Not on the astral plane, whoever the questioner is, but on the buddhic plane, the true illumination is achieved. The body and the lower principles being temporarily asleep, and the inner self liberated in the higher world. Then it was told, the initiated one returned to his body and awoke. Faced with the task then of living out in the world as still a human body and personality, that which had been received and known in the innermost. So this 3 days and three nights comes in a great deal. There were 3 days and three nights of Jesus in the tomb before resurrection. So, yes, thank you for your question, which has led us into an advanced study of the whole story of symbolism and the life of our Lord. May I close by saying that this deeper approach is only offered as a speculative study and need not in any way reduce for us the inspiration of the literal gospel story of the glorious and wonderful life of Jesus and all that he taught and did in the world for men. It is only that certain minds trying to probe more deeply into truth advanced this idea. Thank you. Now there are very many questions. One, for example, from what you have said on correspondences, I understand that for every earthly form, there was a heavenly archetype. Yes, that's what we've been studying. And in brackets, Plato. That's Plato's concept of the divine idea, of which I've been speaking. The earthly form derives from its heavenly archetype through pure Platonism and Kabbalah. But if the form is astromental, is relevant, if the form in astromental, or mental matter, I will add, is relatively evanescent. Now there I'm going to stop, because that supposition with the if in front of it pulls me up. And I would contribute to this statement, it's not a question yet, a statement, that as far as I understand it, there are two kinds of superphysical forms which refer to the question. One, archetypal forms produced in mental matter. That is, forms produced in mental matter by the impact of the power from the archetype. Those are relatively permanent, not evanescent.
There's another kind of form in superphysical matter, which is the result of human thought or of sound. Both of these producing forms. Now, these are emanations. Then the person goes on. The questioner goes on. You said the angels would preserve a form as long as possible, referring to the evanescent type. Are the real archetypes constructed in still higher matter? And are they permanent? That is, more permanent than earthly forms? Yes. The archetype itself is everlasting within Manvantara, within the life of the solar system. The archetype itself at a very much higher level is permanent throughout that period. So that the forms which are produced at the superphysical levels will also be permanent relatively. Everything passes, but relatively permanent. And the eventual physical form will have a relative permanence. Relative only. It will pass. But back to the archetype itself, this is everlasting, permanent. Held in the mind of the Logos, who is the great yogi, whose concentration never wavers for one fraction of a second, from dawn to eve of the creative day. Second, some occult systems teach the sounding three times of the Om. What is the difference in significance between the three and the seven times sounding? Question. Again, within the limits of my understanding, and purely as a proffered idea. A simple answer would be that the seven times chanting would produce a greater effectiveness. It builds up. You may have noticed that as I've chanted. If I chant once to you, it has a certain effect. But if I go on three times, that effect is increased. If I go on seven times, still more. And the yogis, apparently they always chant in multiples of seven. For example, seven times seven. The first multiple of seven will refer to the physical world, bahut, in Sanskrit. The second, the astral world, seven times, with the consciousness focused there. And so on, right on up, to the highest plane. The consciousness of the yogi being elevated by the process of thus chanting. This is mantra yoga. You notice when I chanted the Gayatri, it began by a kind of formal statement of the great planes of nature. Om Bhuh, that's the physical. Om Bhuvaha, astral. Om Suvaha, Om Manaha, Om Janaha, Om Tapaha, Om highest satyam. They begin this great hymn to the sun by an enunciation, a formal statement of the construction of the universe and of the human constitution. And the idea is that you elevate your consciousness as thus you chant. Physical, etheric, astral, mental, buddhic, art. It's a veritable science, you know, and a very old one. And the ideal, as I have said, is as you chant, that should always be the full intent, born of knowledge of what you are doing. And the effectiveness of any mantra depends largely upon the amount of deliberate intent based upon knowledge of what you are doing. So I venture to suggest then that the septenary nature of the universe and of man's vehicles are recognized, and consciousness is focused in them successively as the yogi chants seven times. In addition, of course, there are the levels of consciousness to which the mind is turned, or if you like, the vehicles of consciousness to which the mind is turned as the chanting is done. So you see, this kind of septenary chanting provides the student, the yogi, with a kind of ladder of seven rungs. Really, it goes inwards, not upwards, but diagrammatically, a ladder of seven rungs. So you start at the lower ladder. The idea that your consciousness should ascend or penetrate deeper and deeper to the seventh plane, the Atma, or level or vehicle of consciousness. Continuant chanting, I understand, builds up the effects up to a certain point. I suppose you could go on mechanically so long that you wouldn't produce any more effects. But normally we may say that it builds up the influence and the effect of the chanting. Remember what I have so often said, if I may so presume. Full intent is important. Everything in occultism, the idea that there should never be anything done in a perfunctory manner. See? Not only because you don't get the effect you're aiming at, but because it's... I nearly said because it isn't polite. You know, one has a great respect for occult science and the great occultists who give us the laws and of the universe itself based upon them. And you build up a kind of respect, a reverence for the nature of things, do you see? So you don't use these forces casually. What's the next question? Is it possible to develop only the etheric view, means clairvoyance, in order to see sick parts of a body or disturb chakram, and so to help inquiries about a diagnostic? Yes, yes. But it will always be limited, because that's still the plane of effects, not the plane of causes. But yes, can be done, and it's easier for some people. Questioner goes on, headache can be provoked by many factors, namely liver, hormonal disturbance, influenza, etc. So it may be of the highest interest to discover the weak point. Yes, if it's there. But it rarely is there. Because that's a world of effects you're dealing with, you see. And the occult student always seeks the realm of causes. to get behind the effects, to the root causes. So, a higher form of clairvoyance might reveal, for example, the psychosomatic causes associated with the physical difficulties. They generally exist. Modern medical science, especially in this psychiatric and psychosomatic realm, is finding more and more evidence for this. Later on, maybe we'll be studying these things together in ordered form. Second question from this friend, is it possible to develop such low sightseeing through normal conditions of the modern life, the meaning being only to help? Yes, but the ashram or retreat condition is preferable. It's all better done in retreat, away from all the discordances and distractions of the world. So, hence, of course, the whole principle of the ashram life, the retreat life. But it can be done. How? I try to answer, but my answer is not to be interpreted, please, as encouragement to do this. We're studying academically now. I don't encourage anybody to do this. But if you ask me, I must say, by a union of mantra and Raja Yoga. These two combined. And used with knowledge. And preferably under the guidance of a qualified teacher. It's not advisable. It's not advisable. Unless all your life currents, your dharma and karma, and pathway ahead indicate the possibility. No, I must go further than that. Indicate that this is the sole gateway into the future usefulness. Then you're on fairly solid ground. Otherwise, the whole procedure of unguided occult development and the attainment of hypersensitivity is fraught with danger. For every advance of this kind, a price has to be paid. One of them is hypersensitivity, so that life is doubly and trebly difficult to live. Next, from the same questioner, could you possibly explain to us what are the real deep roots leading an individual to schizophrenia or divided personality? I would normally refuse to answer because I'd be generalizing. And few generalizations are safe. They all need qualifying to fit the particular circumstance. And so, it would be better to have the schizophrenic before you and then offer a suggestion. However, we're students together, and as theosophists, we might think, and I say as far as I know, The schizophrenic condition is, of course, karmic, and it stems or arises from the kind of conduct which has produced it. What kind? Well, again, one needs to see the patient, but in general, I have found deliberate mental cruelty. Planned cruelty. Sadism. This, when karma begins to work, can result in a defective mechanism of consciousness. In fact, I incline to the view, tentatively advanced, that the root cause of nearly all human suffering is unkindness, mounting up to cruelty. And the prevention, kindness, love. As cruelty causes, so kindness prevents the onset of karmic adversities. So I'm inclined to think, always allowing for the modification of karma, as I think I have said. Going on further now, how possibly to help to cure or weaken manifestations of divided personality when the person, not being conscious and not helping through willpower, just thinks we have ups and downs as any normal and cyclical being. How to help them? They won't recognize their schizophrenic condition. Here again you must be quite sure you're right. Are they schizophrenic? Is it ups and down? They may be right, not you. And so it is so important to get to the root of this matter. However, granted that it is really so, then there are certain methods of helping them. I personally believe in certain healing formulae to be used for sufferers of all kinds, whether in presence or in absence. First, whether in groups, and this is very useful in group healing, by the by. First, after the usual preparations for prayer, think of a source of healing power strongly. If you're a Christian, that will be our Lord Christ, the great healer of the world, maybe, or one of the saints, or Our Lady, if we're moved that way. And perhaps if the sufferer is a woman. Or both. Then you link up with our Lord as strongly as you can, closely as you can, in utmost reverence. Then you mentally think of the person first as radiantly healthy and secondly in the Lord's presence, flooded with his healing life. Then you mentally or verbally say, may the healing power of the Lord Christ descend upon us. And you repeat the Christian and surname in Western countries. And you hold that thought, visualizing them thus, charged through and through, penetrated by the Lord's healing grace. Then you may, if you like, add, may the holy angels minister unto them. You think of shining beings surrounding the sufferer. If you like, you can close, may the light of Christ's love enfold them forever. And you're quiet for some minutes, and then amen, and the procedure is over. You can repeat this during the day, in presence or in absence, and you can make a kind of inner spiritual link with the person, which will, as it were, provide a source of healthfulness. There is more of a more deeply occult character. Chanting the Om is very useful in this case, especially if you can get the person to chant. If the person admits and comes to you voluntarily of their own accord, not prompted, of their own accord, and will accept your guidance and wish sincerely to be helped, then teach them to chant the Om. It has a marvelously unifying, aligning effect. Not more than 7 times. Never mind about the science of it. Let them make the noise. The wonderful sound of the name of the eternal deity. There is a hint in that question, or I may be wrong, that oneself, what is to do with oneself? Again, what I have said applies, but we can all help ourselves when we need it by cultivating a state of goodwill to all people. A feeling and consciousness of harmoniousness and harmlessness to all that exists. These are the great preventives against ill health and against the conduct which causes it at the higher levels. So develop a habit of happiness. Somebody has said, you know, that the perfect lubricant for stiff joints is the oil of joy. Want to put it down? The perfect lubricant for stiff joints is the oil of joy. Now, we all have episodes of distress in our lives and auras. And we can't always sincerely do that, but it's a good counsel. Next, do not nurse grievances. Deliberately forgive all who hurt you. as you hope to be forgiven by those whom you hurt. Don't nurse grievances. Don't have smoldering grudges. They're poison. Repeat, send out affection to all. As harmlessness prevents, so goodwill cures disease and suffering. If you want to do more, then link up every day with a source of spiritual power and spiritual blessing. Every day, return to the source of the healing fountain of life which is within each one of us. Tap it and draw upon it, and it will flow through one and to others, of course. But our friend here has another question. In singing the Om in the correct tone, have the vibrations to be expired, he means given out, or kept? I break the question there and say given out. On the long M sound, as you hear me doing, and you probably know yourselves. But the person's asking whether if you keep the sound inside you somehow, chanting without, with your opening your lips, does this have a fuller resonance inside the person as long as the breath lasts? I would say not. No. It's that final M which is so powerful in mantras. So I'm inclined to think that it is better to say the word fully and prolong the M sound. It's rather interesting, you know, that these sounds can, as you hint, be made to operate inside you. You can mentally direct the sound vibrations to any part of your body you like. Into the brain, to the pituitary gland, the pineal gland, to the cerebrum or frontal brain, or the cerebellum. You can do that, and it does set those atoms and cells in heightened vibratory frequency. It will do that in general, but you can intensify if you want to quicken the action of a part of your brain, or if you want to heal a part of your body. Sound the Om verbally here, of course, with your thought at the place of trouble. But in answer in general, I think the physical sound should be expired or exhaled in order to obtain the full mantric effect. Now there's enough time for, I have two more. Amongst others, yeah. You spoke of an etheric mold formed at conception. Would you enlarge upon this? Well, this is a purely personal idea. For one part of my life, which was lived virtually in retreat, I was concerned with a study of disease with a group of physicians and some nurses. And so often the root physical causes seemed to have been traceable to conditions in utero. And so it was decided to make a special study, as I think I've said to you, of expectant mothers and the development of embryo and fetus during the prenatal period. Part of this was published, by the by, in a little book called The Miracle of Birth. One of the doctors writing the introduction. There is it. Don't want it. I don't want it. I don't want it. Thank you. Only mention it if you want to follow it up. That's all. Well, various ladies permitted investigation, and I came to this conclusion to which the questioner refers, that at the moment of conception, the physical permanent atom is attached by an angel to the newly formed twin cell. This permanent atom at the physical level, which we've studied, vivified by the descending egoic creative energy, bestows upon the twin-celled organism its ordered biological impetus, causes it, in fact, to grow by an energy from within, if you like, the egoic word. Well, as this is watched, round that first twin cell, as far as I could see, there began to be formed a kind of enclosing etheric, well, I call it mold, matrix, etheric matrix. And within this, there is to be seen, I think, in terms of flowing energy or lines of force, each on its own wavelengths, a sketch plan of the whole body, every type of tissue to be, is represented there, differing from the other types, because the energy of which it is an end product, is itself on another frequency. So within the etheric mold, it was a wonderful revelation when I first saw it, or thought I saw it. Within the etheric mold, there is a sketch plan, if you like, of the whole body to be, every type of tissue, being represented, each differing because on another frequency. And so the body's structure, muscular and vascular tissues, the nerves, brain and skeleton and all the other substances were all and are, I think, all represented in the etheric mode by currents of energy on specific frequency. Now the interesting point here, since you asked me to enlarge, is this, that studying this, watching this, quite early in the pregnancy, one could discern the effects of karma from former lives operating. They operate
At the physical level, they operate onto the etheric double and mold of the newly forming body. Now, if this is right, then karmic difficulties and deficiencies, which are to work out in terms of some malformation, weakness, latent disease, these are represented in the etheric form by dissonances, discords. Even breaks in the particular lines of force along which the tissues are going to be built. And sometimes, for instance, the line of force which represented the spine was seen to have a break in it, or in some other part of the body. In perfect health, of course, if everything's going to be perfectly healthy, then every part is in tune and the cord of the human body perfectly harmonized. And so there would be no breaks anywhere. In ill health, the opposite exists. There's a dissonance, some part or other. The cord of the tune are made up by the notes and frequencies of all the parts of the body. That cord is out of tune. And from this one can deduce that the true art of healing is the restoration of rhythm. I think that's all I can say to you just now on this important subject. Now, I have time, haven't I, for one more. Yes?
Does this mean that in the future healing would be done by...
It is being done now. Yes?
Therapy, but I'm just wondering if in the future this would be the means of healing.
Well, don't say the means. One of the. Yes. Yes. Yes, well said. It would seem to be logical. I like to dogmatize, especially about the future, which is the most uncertain thing. But it would be, and it is already being used as a useful agency. Yeah. Well, this question is, please explain the idea of the ancient mystery. What were they, and what did they do? Much too big a question, really, for me to answer, but may I make a few suggestions? Needless to say, because they were mysteries, there isn't anything final and actual about their secrets. Even in the Eleusinia, which were public, remember, there is no record in any Greek literature of the time, whatever, which tells what the final secret was. We don't know. The nearest we can get is that at the moment, after the supreme moment of initiation, the Hierophant led the candidate, now an initiate, to a private place. Open doors, and there displayed or revealed some marvelously potent and mysterious objects. There's much speculation as to what they were. It's not known, and from which there radiated a brilliant light. I might perhaps say a few words. There seem to have been, as far as my studies go, at least seven functions of the ancient mysteries. One,
to establish centers of research and scholarship. Exoteric were they were called the lesser mysteries, and esoteric were they called the greater mysteries. And there were grades, you know, in the Egyptian mysteries, 10 in each. And the candidates proved themselves and went through the 10 lesser. And if they then proved worthy and capable and able, then the veil of allegory and symbol and drama was transcended, and the person came right into the greater mysteries. Concerning that, St. Clement of Alexandria, one of the early church fathers, himself an admitted initiate of the mysteries of Eleusinia, of Eleusis, he wrote this about his own initiation. Here all teaching ends. One sees nature and all things face to face. The veil, you see, is rent. So, one, to establish centers of research and scholarship, exoteric and esoteric. Two, to maintain centers of spiritual power and light. Light which is sent radiating over the world. To provide schools of the prophets or secluded sanctuaries where special training and teaching could be given to those among the contemporary population who applied for it. It was a great honor. Great honor.